UFC Credit Corporation against United Business and Industrial Federal Credit Union.
Good morning. May it please the court?
Mr. Borst.
Good morning, Judge. May it please the court? My name is Vince Borst, and I have the pleasure of representing the plaintiff appellant IFC Credit Corporation. This case involves the enforceability of five equipment leases that the defendant, Appellee United Business, entered into with an entity called Norvergence on December 12, 2003. United Business was the lessee under the leases, and Norvergence was the lessor. Norvergence subsequently assigned its rights, but not its obligations, under the five leases to IFC, your appellant. We believe the record shows that IFC took the leases for value without knowledge of any defenses whatsoever on behalf of United Business, and as such constituted a holder in due course of the five leases by assignment. When United Business defaulted under the leases, IFC initiated the litigation that led to this appeal. After a four-day trial, on August 4, 2006, the jury found that although United Business had defaulted under the five leases, that it was not liable to IFC for damages because it signed the leases as a result of fraud and factum. After the district court denied IFC's motion for a new trial under Rule 59 or, alternatively, for judgment as a matter of law under Rule 50, IFC filed this appeal. We believe that there are basically four areas that warrant reversal of the district court's judgment. The first area is the district court's refusal to enforce the jury waiver provision in the leases, and this will be reviewed by the court on a de novo basis. The second area of error is when the district court denied IFC's Rule 50 motion for judgment as a matter of law, and this is also reviewed on a de novo basis. The third area, we believe that the district court abused its discretion when it allowed United Business to raise the defense, the affirmative defense, of fraud in factum on the very eve of trial. It was done 4 days before trial began, and the court will review this for abuse of discretion. Finally, we think the district court erred in the presentation of the fraud in factum defense to the jury, and this is reviewed de novo as well. With respect to our first area, the district court refused to enforce the jury waiver provisions because it felt that the clause was not discussed by the parties at the time of the signing of the contracts, that it was allegedly inconspicuous, and was not reviewed by counsel. The leases, all five leases, are identical. They're a two-page document front and back, and on the second page, the lease states, "You hereby waive right to a trial by jury in any lawsuit in any way relating to this rental." And this provision, by the way, is just mere inches away from Mr. Nurek's initials on the back page, and he's the individual that negotiated these leases and signed them on behalf of United Business. Because this is de novo, you have to look for yourselves and see whether you believe this jury waiver provision is enforceable, and there's essentially four things you need to look at. You need to look at the relative bargaining power of the parties. You need to look at the parties' negotiations. You need to look at the conspicuousness of the clause.
Why do we look at any of those things? This is a term in a contract that's covered by the UCC. Does the UCC identify any of those things to with respect to the enforceability of a contract term?
No, these are...
UCC does ask whether a term would be unconscionable under state law. I haven't seen any argument that this term would be deemed unconscionable under Illinois law.
It's not, Your Honor. And clearly the law establishes this. It's case law that establishes these elements that we look at. There's nothing in the UCC that says a waiver of jury
supervision. So where do these come from? The reason I ask this is because the immediate parallel that came to my mind in thinking about this is arbitration. Suppose the clause said instead of you go to court but it's a bench trial, the clause said you don't go to court at all. You go to an arbitrator selected by the American Arbitration Association. And that, of course, also waives a jury. In fact, it's even a bigger waiver than this clause. And our jurisprudence in asking whether an arbitration clause is enforceable doesn't pose any of those four questions. So I can't see why we would treat this differently than asking whether an arbitration clause was enforceable. Now, is there some reason why we should?
Not necessarily, Judge, but I think to follow your point, I think that the courts are in favor of arbitration clauses. They prefer it over...
In favor of it or against it. The Federal Arbitration Act says just treat it the same as other clauses of contract. The question I'm asking you is there any reason why we would view the enforceability of this clause differently from the way we would view the enforceability of an arbitration clause?
I don't think so, Judge. I think it's the same.
So then I don't understand these four factors, because that's not at all what we would ask in figuring out whether an arbitration clause is enforceable?
Well, I think you would ask, is the clause conspicuous? Is it something that was bargained for? And I think these four factors
assist in that. No, we don't ask. We've affirmatively held that those questions are not relevant to the enforcement of an arbitration clause. We routinely enforce arbitration clauses that appear in form contracts without anybody bargaining for it, without anybody looking at it, and so on.
We have
affirmatively rejected those factors, in other words.
Well, and in the same way, the courts have routinely held that the jury waiver provisions are routinely enforceable as well. I'm walking through the analysis that the judge performed to show that I think his conclusion on the enforceability of this provision is incorrect. I think clearly the parties had the same bargaining power. They negotiated the contract. The record establishes that.
You can say that, but I don't understand why that is any more pertinent than with respect to the enforcement of any other clause in the contract.
Well, I think clearly
the clause in the contract that makes this paper negotiable, which is why, of course, your client has it. And I assume that clause wasn't bargained over individually or reviewed by counsel or anything else. And no one doubts that clause is enforceable.
And the same way I think this clause is enforceable. I think if you did the same analysis, that you would find that this is an enforceable clause. And on that basis, we think the judge committed reversible error when he refused to enforce the jury waiver provision and forced us to try the matter to a jury.
Well, are there any cases in Illinois, if you ask the UCC's question, that is a given clause unconscionable, are there cases in Illinois, whose law governs, addressing the question of the enforceability of jury waivers in particular?
Illinois case law does enforce jury waiver provisions.
After posing and asking the UCC's question? Posing and answering the UCC's question?
I haven't seen that analysis, Judge.
Okay.
We think the district court also erred when it denied IFC's motion for...
I will tell you why I ask that. It's because although both sides talk about Illinois law, neither side cites any Illinois cases. Both sides cite cases from the Northern District of Illinois that may or may not discuss Illinois law. But I always think that when we've got a question under diversity, we need to look at what the state courts are saying rather than what the Northern District of whatever is saying about whatever state courts are saying.
Well, sitting in diversity, Judge, the district court would be applying Illinois law.
Yes, but the district court is not an Illinois court. Whatever it says is just its belief. To figure out what the law of Illinois is, you look at the law of Illinois, not what district judges are saying about it, not what law reviews are saying about it, not what the Chicago Tribune is saying about it. You get my point, I trust.
I take your point, Judge, and Illinois courts do enforce jury waiver provisions.
We just have to take your word for it because your brief doesn't cite any such case.
I grant that our brief does not cite to an Illinois case, Judge. We also think the judge erred when he denied our motion for judgment as a matter of law. He really didn't get to the merits of the motion. He held that IFC had waived the right to bring the motion because we had not renewed a previous motion that we made after the close of our evidence, at the close of all the evidence. During the discussion, counsel for IFC asked the judge, "We're going to rest and we'll make a verbal motion for a directed verdict." The judge stated, "We'll take that up at a later time so you can consider it made, and we'll take that up at a later time." And then counsel reiterated, "And just so I'm clear, we preserve the issue of the directed verdict for a later date." The judge replied, "Yeah, we'll deal with that later." This is the precise situation that this court dealt with in the Smodge versus AT&T case.
Have you read the Supreme Court's opinion in Unitherm Food against Swift Eckrich?
I have not, Judge.
It rejected our approach to Rule 50. Neither side seems aware of the fact that everything in the briefs about Rule 50 predates Unitherm, which made everything both sides have said about Rule 50 irrelevant.
I think
if we want to figure out what Rule 50 means, we do have to consult the decisions of the Supreme Court.
Well, I think, too, though, the courts are moving to a less stringent application of Rule 50.
You obviously haven't read Unitherm, which said that Rule 50 has to be enforced with absolute punctiliousness, no exceptions allowed.
I have not read the case, Judge. But we think that the judge also erred when he denied our motion because if he had looked at the merits of the motion, he would have seen that there was no evidence in the record to support a finding by the jury that there was fraud in factum in this case. fraud and factum is the only real defense that they could have raised against the holder.
Do we have to reach the fraud and the factum question before we can figure out the validity of the jury waiver? The waiver, it's hard to see how the waiver can be enforced if the contract was signed by somebody who thought it was, say, a request for 50 cheeseburgers.
But that wouldn't change the nature of the jury waiver provision. Much the same way you would look at a choice of form, choice of law provision in a contract where you would have to show that that itself would have had to been the actual product of a fraud. For example, it was inserted at a later date. In any event, we don't feel that there's any evidence in the record.
We're under Illinois law. Is that what the Illinois courts say about the sequence? That is, one would enforce a clause in a contract even though the contract itself might be void because of fraud in the factum.
It would be the same analysis as if you were looking at the enforcement of a form selection clause. The courts look to whether there was actual fraud involved in the placement of that provision in the contract. It doesn't void the fact that the parties agreed that they would litigate issues arising from the contract in a particular form. Similarly, it shouldn't affect the fact that the parties bargained for.
I may be misremembering this, but I thought when the Supreme Court said that if you have an arbitration clause, the arbitrator could resolve disputes about fraud in the inducement, but not fraud in the factum. Now, maybe I'm wrong about that.
Well, I believe that the jury waiver provision still would be enforceable. But in any event, there's no evidence.
Is there some case you would rely on for that proposition?
I don't have one to present you today, Judge.
Mr. Borst, would you say that the waiver of a right to trial by jury would fall under the heading of applicable law? Is that a law call?
I think it would be, Judge. I think it's a matter that would be enforceable as a matter of law.
And that's why you've got it lodged as you do under applicable law?
Right.
This type couldn't get any smaller, could it?
It's the same type as the rest of the...
It's
the same type as the rest of the...
Not the heading. The headings carry, like applicable law and return of equipment, and they jump out, security deposit, and then jump out a little bit more.
It's in the same type font as the rest of the contract. It's a simple two-page document. If they had flipped it over and read it, they clearly would have seen that. And I would note that they didn't object to the choice of form, choice of law provision, which is also there as well. Obviously, they felt that that was enforceable. So I don't think that analysis would apply. In any event, there's no evidence in the record that there was fraud in fact in this case. Mr. Nurek, the representative for United Business, clearly testified that he was aware he was entering into an equipment lease. There's no bait and switch that's been performed. He wasn't told he was signing.
There was an instruction on it, though, right? Fraud in fact.
Yes, there was, and I'm going to get to that. I think that's one of the other areas where we have an issue with what Judge Cannelli did.
When you get to it, you might indicate to me what the effect was, a joint instruction being submitted.
I will do that, Judge. But in any event, Mr. Nurek testified that he was clearly aware that he was signing an equipment lease. He knew the full effect of it. And I will address your concern at this point, Judge. During the course of the jury instructions, IFC submitted two jury instructions, which the judge refused to tender. And backing up, the fraud in factum defense was raised for the first time 4 days prior to the trial. We objected to it at that time. Prior to that, the only defense that had been raised was fraud in the inducement. They're two very different defenses. Fraud in factum, as I said, is the only real defense that can be raised as to a holder in due course. We objected then. We went into the jury conference with Judge Cannelli, and we tendered two instructions, which he refused to tender to the jury. And those were instructions that the law presumes that a party who signs a contract knows its terms and consents to be bound by them, and that failure to read a contract does not amount to entering into a contract without knowledge of or reasonable opportunity to understand its terms. At that point, we'd made our position clear to the judge. He instructed us to go out and come back with embodying his ruling on our instructions, agreed your instructions to submit to the jury. So we don't believe we waive the right to object to that. We did object to it going to a jury, and we did object to the his failure, first of all, allowing them to have that defense, and second, to not inserting the instructions that I just mentioned. So we think that was reversible error as well.
Well, how was the verdict finally sent to him or given to him? Was it a joint tender by both the parties?
It was a joint set of instructions, Judge.
I mean, that particular instruction.
Correct. What the judge told us is that I'm not going to submit his instructions. You can argue to the jury in your closing argument. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, so I'll just wrap up that we also feel that the judge committed reversible error and abused his discretion when he allowed the fraud and factum to defense to be raised a mere 4 days prior to trial. Before that, the only defense that had been raised was fraud, and that was done by way of a motion for summary judgment. And then about 2 weeks before the trial, the defendant, United Business, raised fraud in the inducement as a defense. It wasn't until for the first time, 4 days before trial, 9 months after discovery had closed, at that point, we believe that IFC was severely prejudiced because it did not have an opportunity to explore that particular defense. It's a very different defense from fraudulent inducement. And on that basis, we think that the judge committed reversible error, and I'll come back with comment later.
Thank you, Mr. Borst. Ms. Engel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Samantha Engel, and I represent United Business. Today I'd like to focus on three main categories that IFC raises on their appeal, which is the jury waiver, the jury instructions, and the fraud and the factum defense. I'd first like to address the jury waiver clause because we believe this is the only issue that's properly before the Court and that has not been waived. We believe the standard of proof for the jury waiver is, in fact, a manifest way to the evidence and not the de novo standard that IFC contends. The reason being that this is not a legal issue. It's a very fact-intensive inquiry that the courts apply. And it's specifically...
The same question I asked Mr. Borst. Is there any reason why the validity of this clause would be treated differently than the validity of an arbitration clause?
Well, there's a few reasons, Your Honor. As Your Honor pointed out, the UCC does require that contracts are not unconscionable and that there's a good faith obligation in every contract. Secondly, and more importantly, I think at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter what clauses were in there when the jury...
Address my question, please. Is there any reason why the validity of a jury waiver should be treated differently from the validity of an arbitration clause?
No, the only thing I'd say to that is that, you know, it's very typical in an arbitration setting that the parties will separately acknowledge the arbitration clause, they'll initial that there's an arbitration
waiver.
No,
that's extraordinarily rare. We've had a series of recent cases involving arbitration clauses in form contracts exactly like this. And in a number of those cases, the district court has held the arbitration clause won't be enforced if there was disparity of bargaining power or unless it was separately negotiated, and all of those cases have been reversed. We have said, following the Federal Arbitration Act, that unless the arbitration clause would be unconscionable as a matter of state law, it will be enforced. And all those arguments about disparity of bargaining power, or it's in a form contract, and so on, are completely irrelevant. Right? The question I'm asking is, isn't that the right approach to use here? Because every arbitration clause waives a jury, and it waives other stuff too. In fact, it waives the access to a court. One would think that a jury waiver is a lesser included case of an arbitration clause.
And I'd say that the distinction that I can point out is that that follows the Arbitration Act, as Your Honor points out, whereas we are following fundamental contract principles.
I'm lost. The Federal Arbitration Act says an arbitration clause is enforceable save on grounds that a state would have for not enforcing any equivalent clause. right? So that would send us to state law to ask the question, does Illinois permit jury waivers, or would it treat a jury waiver as unconscionable? And I have the same concern about your brief as I had about Mr. Boris. Your brief doesn't cite any Illinois cases on this point. So I've tried to find out whether Illinois would treat jury waivers as unconscionable, the UCC standard, and haven't had much luck.
Your Honor, I'm at a loss, too, and I'd say the only distinction I have is that this doesn't fall under the Arbitration Act. I have no case in Illinois. But I believe the standard that the Northern District, at least, has been applying does require a weighing of the evidence, which is fact-intensive.
I understand what standard the Northern District of Illinois has been applying, but every time they apply that standard to an arbitration clause, we reverse.
And if we're applying an unconscionability
standard,
unless
there is a reason why this should be treated differently from arbitration, you see the problem.
I do see the problem. And I think that an analysis of unconscionability as well would require a weighing of factors and a fact-intensive inquiry that would not be a legal question and not be reviewed de novo. I also want to...
I didn't see any argument in your brief that this clause was unconscionable under Illinois standards. Did I miss something?
We have a more generalized argument that states that the whole contract was unconscionable, and it comes in at the end of our brief when we're discussing finance leases. But no, we do not have an argument on specifically addressing the jury waiver as being unconscionable. But I would submit that at the end of the day, it really doesn't matter. You know, when we asserted a fraud in the factum defense, and we believe the evidence supported that defense, this defense voids the contract at its inception, and therefore all provisions therein would be void. So whether it's a jury waiver or an arbitration clause...
Let me ask you the other principal question I asked of Mr. Borst. Does the court have to resolve a fraud in the factum argument before it reaches the validity of the jury waiver? We know from Prima Paint that fraud in the inducement is not resolved ahead of the validity of internal clauses. So, for example, an arbitrator will resolve a claim of fraud in the inducement. Is fraud in the factum treated differently for that purpose?
I agree with Your Honor that I think the fraud in the factum issue is the first issue that must be addressed, because if it's found, and it was found by this jury, it vitiates the contract. It vitiates all the provisions therein. So, yes,
well,
I do believe it needs to be.
Do you have authority for this proposition?
I'm sorry?
Do you have authority?
That the fraud in the factum would deem a contract
the fraud
void?
In the factum has to be resolved ahead of a decision whether to enforce a jury waiver or an arbitration clause or something like that.
I don't have a case directly on point, but I would point to the Aliano Brothers case. I believe it was IFC versus Aliano Brothers, decided by this court, which it was a forum selection clause case, and this court remanded it back to the Northern District, stating that if the defendant would like to assert that the clause itself was fraudulently obtained, then they could do so. So I believe that there is these real defenses. The purpose of having a real defense is that it can vitiate the entire contract. You can't waive all your rights. You can't. Another real defense would be incompetency, and you can't.
You're just making the argument that the Supreme Court rejected in Prima Paint about fraud and the inducement. I'm trying to figure out whether fraud in the inducement and fraud in the factum are treated differently for this purpose. And repeating an argument that's equally true for fraud in the inducement won't help figure that out.
Well, they are different defenses, in that fraud in the inducement is not a real defense. It only deems a contract voidable and not void. That's the distinction here. I think that, you know, on the jury waiver issue, if we want to talk about substantively, you know, the judge decided it. We briefed it. We orally argued it. We rebriefed it. He reconsidered it. And that was his decision. I think all the evidence in the case supported that decision, and that Judge Cannelli's decision about the jury waiver should be upheld. Getting to another issue that IFC raises, which I think all really come under the same purview, is the jury instructions and our assertion of a new affirmative defense. And these arguments, we contend, have all been waived by IFC's submission of its joint agreed jury instructions.
Do you have any reservation, make any reservation with regard to the submission of that? In other words, saying we're agreeing that this is the best word it can be, but we still disagree with the fact that it should be given?
There were several in-chambers discussions, and Judge Cannelli was very clear as to how we were to preserve our objections. So we're going to be discussing these things. You can, you know, object and fight all you want, and then we're going to go back in the courtroom. We're going to put it all on the record, and you can make whatever objections you want. And that night we were instructed to come up with instructions. IFC actually emailed the instructions to Judge Cannelli and stated these are agreed joint jury instructions. The next day we went on the record. The judge said, do you guys have any objections? IFC took the opportunity to point out a typo in those instructions. They didn't take the opportunity to object to our fraud in the factum instructions. They didn't take the opportunity to object to the court's exclusion of their two additional instructions. And they had this opportunity. And UBI took the opportunity to, again, object to the finance leases. The finance leases became part of the jury instructions. And at the Rule 51 conference, we stated, you know, these are joint agreed instructions. However, we still contend that these are not finance leases, and we object to the finance lease issues being in those instructions.
Ms. Engel, was the inquiry, when it went on the record by the judge, did he go through each instruction, or did he just make a general statement? Do you object to anything that we're going to get?
He made a general statement. In chambers, we had gone through everything. We had gone through several drafts. There was red line versions going back and
forth.
How
many total instructions were there?
I'm sorry?
How many total instructions were there, if you recall?
You know, I don't. I know it got up to 29, but I believe some were taken out, so I don't think there was actually 29.
So when he came to the point where he said, we're going to now go over the instructions I'm going to give, he didn't go 1 through 29 and get agreed or disagree on any of them?
We did that in chambers. That was not on the record.
But I thought he said he was going to memorialize them on the record.
He submitted that they were, that, you know, this is the joint agreed instructions that we received last night from counsel. And if there's any further discussion or objections you'd like to have, let's get it on the record now. In addition to our submission that these issues were waived, we also believe that it really comes down to an issue of prejudice. And at the end of the day, IFC was not prejudiced by our inclusion of the fraud and the factum instructions, by our inclusion of the fraud and the factum defense in general. Number one, they knew about this defense. They knew about this defense, we contend, before UBI even knew about this defense. They had approximately 525 cases related to these Norvergence leases, and many, if not all of them, were discussing issues of fraud. Further, the record reflects that we have been raising these same facts and contentions about fraud, about the assigner committing fraud, back in March of 2005, which is nearly a year and a half before trial, when we had been fighting over discovery. We've been fighting to get discovery with regard to the relationship between IFC and Norvergence. And at that point, you know, former counsel for UBI, I think it was Ed Bogle, stated, you know, we're getting new information here, and we have reason to believe that there was a fraud committed by the assigner. So at the very least at that point, IFC is on notice that we are contending that this contract was entered into with the use of fraud. And at another conference...
When was the first time you made it clear that the kind of fraud you had in mind is fraud in the factum?
I would argue that it was clear, at least at the time of our submission of our answer to summary judgment, because we quoted the statute at that point. We had quoted Section 305 that stated there's some real defenses that can that exist even as against a holder in due course. And we quoted some of the comments from 305, and this was, in fact, the fraud and the factum defense. I believe we mislabeled it at that point because we were still calling it fraud and the inducement. And, you know, this was careless, but like I said, at the end of the day, they're put on notice. We've set forth the statute. There's no prejudice.
How many cases did you said there are with regard to this particular issue?
I think the evidence showed that there was, I think it was 500 to 550. I think another number that we received was 525. Just with IFC.
Some we've dealt with already, this court's dealt with already.
Yes, I believe so. And I think what's most interesting is, you know, they bring up in the reply brief that Judge Cannelli did not give them that. Judge Cannelli asked them specifically, on point, you know, what kind of discovery would you have conducted had this fraud and inducement defense come up earlier? And counsel for IFC said, nothing. There's nothing that we would have done. And they point out in their reply brief, well, you know, Judge Cannelli never asked us about the fraud and the factum defense, what discovery we would have, you know, needed if that was asserted earlier. And, you know, it's interesting because, again, they failed to state what discovery they would have taken. And, you know, I believe it's because there is no further discovery they would have taken. Whether it's fraud and the inducement or fraud and the factum, our story's always been the same. The facts and contentions to support either of those defenses has always been the same, and it revolves around the transaction between Michael Nurek, who's the UBI representative, and Nervergence. And they took discovery on that. They deposed him on that. They cross-examined him on that. They propounded written discovery on that. They've taken discovery regarding this defense. It's only the legal ramifications of the defense that changed. And again, I'd submit that there's no prejudice there. You know, they talk about how, with regard to the fraud and the factum, they say this is not a bait and switch. This is not your classic bait and switch where you have some papers and it's literally physically switched in front of you. And I would submit that this is exactly a bait and switch. It's a more clever bait and switch because the transaction involved between UBI and Nervergence was the negotiations, the discussions all revolved around services. How much are services? What are we going to save you on services? What, you know, and the equipment was incidental to this. Like, oh, we have these matrix boxes. You're going to need them in order to receive these services. And that's the only discussion that was had. And the switch came where, when they're talking about the cost being for services, and suddenly at the end, the entire cost was built into the equipment leases, that's the switch. They said that, you know, they were talking about the cost of the services and said the matrix boxes are free. And there was evidence that showed that they were free, that, you know, I think it was defense exhibit number 21 was an invoice, and it says matrix box free, and it labels some other things that are free, and the cost came in where they talked about services. The switch came where he signs off on a piece of paper that builds in the entire cost in the equipment. That's a bait and switch. It's a clever one, but it's a bait and switch. And I think that another thing I want to talk about quickly, because I see my time is running out, is that it's not, you know, explicitly in the briefs, is the choices that IFC made here. And there are a number of choices that financiers can make and precautions they can take and due diligence that they can conduct in order to reduce their risk in financing things. And it's very clear that IFC did the bare minimum. They didn't do much due diligence. They got these financial statements with these explosive revenues, no debt. They know that this is a fastly growing company. They know there's got to be service contracts out there with third parties because they're not providing the services. Where's the debt? Where do they owe, you know, who do they owe money to if they have somebody providing all this service? They have $100 million in revenue and no debt. It doesn't make any sense. They didn't ask for further financials. They didn't ask to see the matrix box. If they saw the matrix box, they'd see that it was, you know, it's just a typical Atran router, and it's not worth $100,000 over 5 years. And they knew this, and they knew that there were side contracts for, or not even side contracts, they knew that the Norvergians was contracting for services, and they knew that the equipment had no value without the services. So the fact that they wouldn't do any due diligence as to whether Norvergians could actually provide, could or would provide these services is careless at best, and, you know, as we submit, was fraudulent. They didn't look at the matrix box. They knew that the Salzanos, who were involved in some FCC problems, were involved in this country, in this company, and they didn't take any further time to really inquire as to what their involvement was. The contracts themselves, they made some choices too, and I understand the financiers. There's policy reasons financiers want these waiver defenses clauses. They want hell or high water clauses, and there's, in certain circumstances, good purposes for that. But if they want them in there, there's precautions they can take. They can make sure that they are conspicuous enough. They can make sure it's not just part of the boilerplate language. They can, and as Your Honor pointed out, maybe it is, you know, you don't see it that frequently, but they could have a party separately acknowledge these provisions if it's so important to them, and they'd be safer there. So, you know, they talk about allocation of the risk and that they, you know, they allocated to UBI and UBI took all this risk, and you know, I would submit that they allocated it back to themselves by sticking their head in the sand and doing the bare minimum of due diligence and of this. I don't even know if they saw the contracts or not in the first place. And, you know, they did a verbal audit, and they kept this verbal audit. Oh, I see I'm out of time, but if Your Honor has any questions.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Boris?
Let me start with the last first. Counsel apparently has a lot of issues with what IFC did and choices they made. The record is replete with IFC's due diligence conducted prior to entering into any assignments of leases with Norvergians, but let's not forget that it's not IFC, this conduct that's on trial here today. What we're focusing on is what the lessee did, both in looking at the contract and in how they chose to handle affirmative defenses. Counsel made a generalized statement about, you know, we made an argument that the whole contract was unconscionable and everything was unconscionable about this transaction, and therefore that should apply to the jury waiver provision. There was no argument made that the jury waiver provision was unconscionable, and indeed the UCC doesn't provide in it that a jury waiver is unconscionable. With respect to jury instructions, IFC did object to the entire matter going to a jury. There was a lot of colloquy in chambers that's been admitted into the record through supplementation. It clearly establishes what IFC's objections were, so I do not believe that we've waived that point. With respect to the fraud in fact and defense, I think as you're reviewing the record, you're going to see that there's a lot of confusion on the part of the United Business as to exactly what their defense was.
Well, I can certainly understand that, but it's very difficult to see how your side of the litigation could have been confused, since fraud in the inducement is utterly irrelevant to a holder in due course. The defense had to have been fraud in the factum, because otherwise it's completely pointless. So why aren't you preparing from day one to meet a fraud in the factum argument?
Because the defense had not been raised. Now, the first time they didn't raise the fraud in the inducement affirmative defense until after discovery had closed, and they didn't raise the fraudulent fraud in factum defense until 4 days before trial. It's not for us to divine what might be in their heads as to their defense. If they raise a defense that is ineffective as to our claim, we're happy to let them pursue that.
Mr. Bush, what about Ms. Engel's point that, or her observation that inquiry was made once the by the district court on the fraud in factum issue, whether or not more discovery was needed, and the representation is that you said you did not need any more.
That's incorrect, Judge. If you go to Record 158, it's Item 8 in our appendix at page 23 and 27. What we said we didn't need any additional discovery for was fraudulent inducement. The argument was made that we generally raised fraud in our motion for summary judgment, so they should have known we were talking about fraudulent inducement, and they specifically limited that discussion with the judge to fraudulent inducement. They had no evidence from Norvergians that there was any fraud. the evidence that they had given with respect to this lease indicated that there was no fraudulent inducement. So we didn't need discovery on that point. The point of fraud in factum wasn't brought up until 4 days prior to trial, and that's an entirely different defense and something we should have been allowed to conduct discovery on and provided the opportunity to do that. And so it was extremely prejudicial that that, first of all, that it went to the jury, and second, that the fraud in factum defense was presented to the jury.
What did you argue that you needed a further discovery on? What matters did you need to know more?
We didn't argue that. The defense came up on the eve of trial, and the judge was not going to continue it.
Well, did you say you needed discovery for particular purposes?
No, we objected to the fact that he was allowing it at that late date and stated we had not had discovery on that point.
But that didn't tell him, here's the points we needed further discovery on.
Did you ask to
tell him for that?
Did you ask to reopen the discovery so you could conduct discovery on this subject?
We did not, Judge.
Mm-hmm.
No, I see that my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.